So good afternoon, everybody. This is a nice, cozy group. I'm glad that you could join us today as we take another look at the ongoing crisis in Venezuela. My name is Carl Meacham, and I'm the director here of the Americas Program. I'm very happy, very excited to have Boz with us. He's a regular. And I'm excited and happy to say that. As many of you know, last week we were able to host Maria Corina Machado the day before she spoke at the OAS as an alternate representative for the Panamanian delegation. That was a huge event, very successful. She was able to speak, I think, for a little bit after some ugly incidents at the OAS. In today's event, though, we're going to be focusing on social media and the protest movements in Venezuela from a blogger's perspective. And we're going to be exploring the role of social media as an important tool for sharing information and news in such a dynamic and complex situation as what we're seeing in Venezuela. I'll leave it up to Boz to talk about the situation in Venezuela, but what I'm going to do, and he'll talk about it as it relates to social media and the role that it's been playing, but what I want to do is just give you sort of a rundown of the events that have occurred during the past 2 months. Most of you know that Venezuela has witnessed massive protests and demonstrations since February and has experienced extremely violent clashes between government and protesters, resulting in at least 32 deaths, 300 injured, and 1,500 arrests, and upwards of 50 allegations of torture of protesters at the hands of the government officials, according to most recent reports. Just as troubling, we've seen a recent wave of persecution of members of the opposition, including the mayor of San Cristobal, Daniel Ceballos, the mayor of San Diego, Enzo Scarano, both presently being held by the government as political prisoners, and the deputy for the state of Miranda in the National Assembly, or former deputy, Diosdado Cabello's announcement Monday in reference to Maria Corina Machado. And to add to the controversy, President Maduro himself announced yesterday the arrest of 3 Air Force generals for alleged plot to overthrow him and his government, claiming that the unnamed officers had links to the opposition and were conspiring to launch a coup. Meanwhile, the protesters and their ensuing clashes continue throughout many of the country's states, and the death toll continues to rise. As we've seen other conflicts around the world, including Ukraine and more recently Turkey, social media and smartphones have played a crucial role in these conflicts. Venezuela has been no different in this regard. In Venezuela, we saw a great deal of censor soon after the larger protests began in February, first with the blocking of some of Twitter's services and the Colombian news channel NTN24, and then with the targeting of much of CNN and Espanol's staff in country. Reporters and photographers have also reported attacks, repression, and destruction of equipment from government officials. And Venezuelans have been among the most active on social media websites and apps like Twitter and Facebook, nevertheless reporting on the ground and in real time where many reporters couldn't be. We heard from some friends in Silicon Valley, a company called Anchor Free, who has tried to be helpful and made their hotspot Shield iPhone app, which provides enhanced security and privacy while bypassing government net blockades and censorship. They made this app free for Venezuelans. So in many ways, the work that Boz is doing and that of other independent websites and blogs has provided constant, reliable, and accessible information and analysis on the most complex issues underlining the conflict. And thankfully, we have him here today. James Bosworth is a partner and director of analysis at Southern Pulse, a strategic advisory firm focused on Latin America. There, Boz oversees the firm's analytical framework and directs research design efforts for long-term in-depth engagements. Based in Mexico City, Boz also writes for his own site. Many of you are probably following, Bloggings by Boz, in which he presents his own analysis and opinion on foreign policy and current events in Latin America. And he's also a senior associate here in my program at CSIS. So it's great to have you today. As a reminder, we're on the record, we will have a recording of this audio up, which we'll distribute on our Facebook page and on our Twitter page. So when you have questions, and this is a great group because I think a lot of this might end up being conversational after Boz opens up, just make sure when you have questions, just identify yourself so you'll be registered when we record this and you're famous all around the world along with Boz.
On social media.
Yes, so without further ado, here's Boz.
Great.
No, thanks, Carl. I appreciate the invitation. I'm looking forward to talking a bit and then opening this up for questions because I do want to have a conversation, and I do enjoy answering questions as they come up. It tends to spark a lot of discussion. Let me start with a quick digital divide note. There's a belief by the government that the protests are this elite group of economic elite, only the rich, and it's been somewhat reported online that this idea that social media as it's reporting protests are simply the economic elite of Venezuela reporting amongst themselves. Only the people who have internet access would be actually on Twitter and talking. About just over 50% of Venezuelans are online. So if you want a great, praise for Hugo Chavez here for a second, Hugo Chavez actually got a whole lot of people online in Venezuela. So over 50% are online. And one recent poll showed that at least 45% of people report that they were receiving information about the protests via social media. About the same number as are receiving it from television. And so this isn't some sort of mini 1% of the population that is communicating, or even top 10% of the population. This is about half of the population. Now, half of the population doesn't have internet, or perhaps 40%. So there is a digital divide in Venezuela, and the people who do not have internet are more likely to be the lower economic class. They're more likely to be pro-Chavez supporters. There is a digital bias, but that digital bias is not complete. It is not geez, the rich are online and the poor are not. There is plenty of representation by Chavistas online. There are plenty of representation by the lower economic classes, though it does need to get better, as it does throughout Latin America. It's not exclusive to Venezuela that there's a digital divide among economic classes. About one quarter of Venezuelans go online every day. So if you're looking for, about 50 to 55, maybe as high as 60% have some form of internet access. A lot of that comes via smartphone. Some of it comes via work. Some of it comes via school. 25% access every day, which means they have a pretty solid connection either at their house or via their smartphone. So as these protests begin, Venezuela's media environment is one of the most controversial topics you can talk about because there is a fair amount of censorship that goes on. There's a fair amount of self-censorship that goes on. But the opposition does still have some representation within the media environment. And so there's this binary debate over, the government says that the opposition controls all the private media and therefore they have this high representation across the board. And the opposition insists that no, they're being censored. Venezuelan news outlets have been shut down. They've been forced to block images that have been portrayed as violent. The government is restricting newsprint imports. I mean, and you get in this binary debate of, is there censorship? Is there not censorship in the mainstream media? The answer is there's a lot of self-censorship. There's a fair amount of the government isn't going in and closing down television channels every day. They're not forcing the hand of Global Vision, but Global Vision has begun to shift its attention away from anti-government and towards the pro-government side. There's a certain amount of self-censorship, self-bias going on, and so as the opposition wants to get into the communications, they begin communicating with each other over social media and news about. Venezuela begins going over social media, but I actually want to back up a few years. In 2010, early 2010, Hugo Chavez was facing another set of protests, not quite as large as the ones that are going on right now, but they were also being reported across social media by student protesters. And Chavez got on the air and he called Twitter users terrorists. Said anyone using Twitter is a terrorist, and he promised he was going to shut down the Twitter network to prevent a potential problem with in terms of opposition, you know, utilizing the social network to either organize a coup or simply promote their own message. Take what you will, he often just kind of spouted off the cuff. And as you all know, Chavez didn't actually do that. Within a few months, Chavez was a much smarter, savvier politician than Nicolas Maduro will ever hope to be. And Chavez realized that Twitter actually was a great advantage in his favor. And within a few months, he had joined Twitter and quickly became the second most followed leader in the world, only after Barack Obama, on Twitter. He utilized Twitter to a level of media and political savviness that we may forget. In today's Venezuelan environment, he wasn't combative on Twitter the way that you may think. You know, Nicolas Maduro goes after and calls the opposition fascists. Chavez didn't do that on a regular basis. If you run through Chavez's Twitter feed, it's actually a pretty calm portrayal of what is going on in Venezuela. It's revolutionary, but it's not the same level of vitriol that you see from the government today. He was a savvy social media user who understood the environment, understood the audience. He also apparently had many advisors assisting in writing that feed and had a long thought out strategy as to how he wanted to use it. But he was fairly savvy at how he managed it. And after Chavez's death and his Twitter silence, which occurred at the same time, some people argued, hey, maybe he'll just continue on talking. After his death and his Twitter silence, Maduro actually only joined Twitter right after Chavez died, a couple weeks later, in preparation for the campaign. And Maduro has almost a bipolar nature in the sense that he wants to support. He wants to use Twitter. He has advisors encouraging him to post photos and messages on there, and at the same time, Maduro seems to think Twitter users are terrorists. He takes this combative approach in which he views social media users, and very specifically Twitter. And you'll hear me talk a lot more about Twitter than you will about Facebook and other networks. And the reason is Facebook is interesting. There's actually, you know, via statistics, 110% of Venezuelan population is currently on Facebook. And that happens because there's a lot of companies on Facebook. People have multiple accounts. There's spam accounts, whatever the case may be. There's more Facebook accounts based in Venezuela than there are people on the internet in Venezuela. About 12% of internet users in Venezuela use Twitter, anywhere between 12 and 15%. But Twitter is where the political action happens. Twitter is where political commentary happens. Twitter is where Maduro comments, Capriles responds. And if the Venezuelan media, mainstream media, is going to cover something, or BBC is going to cover something, or the Washington Post is going to cover something, it's going to be what Capriles says on Twitter or what Maduro says on Twitter. They really don't care what they post to Facebook or Instagram or the other networks. And so when you hear me refer to Twitter and social media almost interchangeably with regards to Venezuelan politics, that's why. At the moment of the election in April of 2013, there was this interesting moment in which the election returns are coming in. There's some controversy, and all of Venezuela's internet shuts down, April 15th, 2013. And the Venezuelan government on that day acknowledged that they shut off the internet for the country for, they say, 3 minutes. It would look to be closer to 10 to 15 minutes. They have a kill switch, and that's one of the most interesting things to have come up from a capabilities perspective, is that the Venezuelan government has a kill switch on the internet. They can throttle the internet to slow it down, and they can shut it off completely throughout the entire country. And they have that ability in large part because Hugo Chavez nationalized CanTV, which is the major ISP in the country, internet service provider. And there's really only one solid link, maybe two now that they built a connection to Cuba, but that doesn't really count. One solid link in and out of the country via internet. The internet is, you know, both metaphorically and physically, a series of tubes, as Senator Ted Stevens once put it. But it is a series of cables. You can look at the cables on, you know, you find a map of the internet cables online, you'll see that there's one cable in and out. Venezuela has the ability to shut off the internet completely. And over time, somewhat with the help of the Cuban government, I don't like to give the Cuban government too much credit for things going on in Venezuela, but in this case, it's true. The Cuban government has assisted with a more subtle sort of censorship role in Venezuela, with their ability in order to block very specific websites. In November 2013, Maduro took to live TV and announced he was going to block websites. This isn't a conspiracy coming from the opposition that Maduro is blocking websites. He actually said on live TV, I'm going to block the following websites, and listed them off, and that included Dollar Today. Dollar Today is an opposition-run website that was publishing the black market rate, and the Venezuelan government determined that publishing the black market rate was against whatever media law they wanted to claim, and Dollar Today became blocked. So Dollar Today starts using various other URLs, which is the reference locator for you know, it's www.bloggingsbyboz.com, not to promote that. So Dollar Today begins changing their URL so that Venezuelans can access the site. And every day on Twitter, Dollar Today posts a new link to their new site, and it would take the Venezuelan government several hours to actually block Dollar Today from being accessed in Venezuela. The other term you're going to need to know here is DNS. DNS are domain name servers. Domain name server is like the internet address book. Basically, when you put in www.bloggingsbyboz.com or dollartoday.com or whatever the case may be, the DNS system is what changes that address into a series of numbers, 8.4.7.3. And that address is where the website is hosted. So Dollar Today begins, trying to help Venezuelans get around the DNS system, the blocking that's going on. And they use URL shorteners on Twitter, including one called bit.ly, bit.ly, which is, essentially shortens the address so that you can read it on Twitter. So the Venezuelan government blocked bit.ly. It's an ongoing battle between Dollar Today and the Venezuelan government. And as you'll see, you're about to see, it gets more interesting once these protests begin. On February 11th, so right, the protests started on February 2nd, but really hit stride around February 12th, 13th. William Castillo, the head of CONATEL, declares that the media coverage of Venezuela and the violence and the protests likely violates the media law, and they're going to begin blocking more websites. On 20 February, Táchira went dark. The Venezuelan government blocked internet out of the state of Táchira for 36 hours. It was just once again proof that they have a kill switch to block things completely. They can also block things selectively throughout the country. Zello is an app you can download on your iPhone, and it serves as kind of a CB radio style issue, walkie-talkie. You can talk one-to-one, or you can actually broadcast multiple. And the protesters in Caracas are using Zello in order to organize. Zello was blocked on 20 February. And so what occurs after Zello is blocked is Zello is based in the United States. At 9 p.m. that night, the owner starts getting all these messages over Twitter saying it's blocked in Venezuela, it's blocked in Venezuela. They went on a 24 to 48 hour hackathon, rewrote their software from scratch so that it could be used in Venezuela, and less than 2 days later actually released a new version that Venezuela has been unable to block. It was an impressive sort of get around. And you had mentioned, several other companies are facing similar problems. On March 10th, TunnelBear was taken offline. What's TunnelBear? TunnelBear is a system that you can put into your DNS structure so that you can get around blocked websites. And so when a company like Anchor Free or a company like TunnelBear allows people to use their DNS system, it allows them to get around the government blockades. Well, the government's starting to block places like Anchor Free and TunnelBear, trying to prevent people from getting around the blockages. We've seen something similar in Turkey. The government in Turkey has shut down Twitter, and they've shut it down via a DNS structure. And so around Turkey, you see people putting graffiti up for 8.8.8.8, which is Google's domain name server, DNS. And if you were to alter your computer settings manually, you can get around Turkey's domain blockade, which is why there are government ministers in Turkey still on Twitter, even though the country's officially blocked it. People in Venezuela are trying to find solutions in order to get around. Anonymous is one. It's a proxy server system. It's been blocked by the Venezuelan government. So how do you report that things have been blocked? Well, there's a website called Herdict, H-E-R-D-I-C-T. It's a website where users can report that, hey, this website is blocked in this location, this website is blocked in this location. What do you think the Venezuelan government did? They blocked Teradict. There's been reports that NTN24 has been blocked. There's been reports that La Patilla, one of the a website based out of Venezuela where a lot of opposition users run, has been blocked, and Pastebin has been blocked. Pastebin is a favorite among hackers around the world. Basically, you can post anonymous messages, and there have been multiple reports that Pastebin has been blocked. Why am I delivering all these very specifics? And the reason is because the debate over censorship in Venezuela is often you're censoring, you're not. We can prove all of these websites have been specifically censored by the Venezuelan government in an attempt to crack down on the movement of protesters who are trying to speak and try and deliver information. How good is the web censorship? I mentioned there are routes around it. Well, you have to remember, this is a government that can't keep toilet paper on the shelves. Their ability to censor the web is you know, it's okay. They have training, they have some foreign assistance, but people can get around it. And that's one of the arguments, you know, against, you know, geez, Venezuelan government censoring. No, they're not. You know, 20, 30, 40% of Venezuelans are still able to get around. If most people in this room, if you gave yourself 10 to 15 minutes, could figure out a way around the web censorship. This is not China's great firewall. You don't need a private VPN server that you're paying $100 a year for. There are ways around the system, but that said, even putting a very limited blockade in place, you know, disrupts the ability for the average Venezuelan to access services. And when Twitter Pictures was blocked, which was probably Twitter Images was blocked, which was one of the biggest things and was reported internationally, most people are not going to be using a DNS changer to get around that. And so the Twitter Images get blocked. Most people, and if 40% of Venezuelans are getting their protest information from Twitter, they're no longer able to see these pictures. We know that the government can block all of Twitter, but then again, the government has every single minister on Twitter. They have a ministry for social media. If they were to block it, it would disrupt their own communications as well. So they have to think about what they're doing. There's some problems with social media. I mean, you know, it's not this big panacea where the opposition can show off everything that they're doing. There are plenty of Chavistas on social media, and social media tends to present a divided society and polarized society, and there's arguments it may even enhance the polarization, which is not necessarily a good thing. Even though you can access, you know, opposition information via, or, you know, information other than what you believe via social media, I guess would be the way I would put it. Most people tend to only go to follow the people who they agree with. You know, and multiple pieces of research show this. And to some extent, opposition people are talking to opposition people. Chavistas are talking to Chavistas. They're not communicating. They may be bashing each other on social media. They may be insulting each other on social media. They're not communicating with each other on social media. It's not promoting dialogue. And to some extent, if the government is interested in polarization, that is something that has to be considered, is that social media is actually somewhat polarizing. Another issue is the ability to verify information via social media. You know, we've seen images go out that claim to be Venezuela that weren't, and the Venezuelan government has grabbed onto every single example of that as proof that the Twitter people are absolutely wrong and trying to overthrow them, and look how evil they are. There have been images from Syria, from Chile, from Colombia protests that have appeared on Venezuelan social media claiming to be protests, and they haven't been. The ability to verify on the ground is really important. And for companies that are operating in Venezuela, for reporters that are operating in Venezuela, you know, this is important. There's this desire, real-time desire, to actually know what is going on right this second. That's why, you know, we consistently check. If you're on Twitter, you're consistently checking it. That's why the reason why when your email rings, you look at it. You want to know information right that minute. But there's a need for a pause in social media and a verification process if you're actually making investment or business decisions out of Twitter. You need to pause. You need to back away. You know, the ability, you know, the potential that something is reported and is then wrong is high. The other thing, there was an op-ed in the New York Times last week about whether social media actually contributes to long-term protests. This is something I brought up. I spoke at CSIS last year about Brazil and social media and the protests there, and something I brought up is, well, social media organizes protests, but it may not change policies. And that's something we saw in Brazil. Protests were organized, lots went on. Yes, they didn't raise the bus fare by 10 cents in Sao Paulo, but social media didn't lead to a giant change in the country's policies. The op-ed in the New York Times was referencing Turkey, was referencing Egypt in terms of social media helped bring people to the streets, but it didn't necessarily change the governments over long term. And we may be seeing the same thing in Venezuela. Social media has brought protests to the streets, helped them organize, helped protesters speak to each other. It's not clear yet whether social media is actually going to change the government, change policy, or change the government's policies for that matter, even if the same government remains in place. One of the questions, as we've watched, Maduro is very nervous about the military, and we saw three Air Force generals arrested yesterday. Solid reports say that military units cannot communicate with each other. They've been blocked from communicating with each other. They must all communicate through a central command. And this is to prevent them from communicating with each other in order to format some sort of unrest or coup. Maduro's biggest fear has to be that the military figures out how to use Twitter or Zello. Because it wouldn't be hard for military units to communicate with each other via social media or via the same tools that the opposition is using to communicate and coordinate. They may not use their radio networks and their military walkie-talkies, but they all have smartphones. And it wouldn't be hard for them to do that. And that's in terms of how people communicate, the government can communicate within its own rights, the military can communicate with its own rights. Social media isn't just a protest organization by the Venezuelan opposition. Chavistas at the neighborhood level can use it to communicate for their Bolivarian circles, and they may find that they may not agree with every national government policy, or the military can use it, or government ministers can use it to back channel with each other. Those sorts of things can happen, and that's actually a much more powerful use of social media than potentially, a Twitter hashtag trending internationally as occurred last week after the OAS. One final comment, and I brought this up before, but there is a need to slow media down. Not in terms of governments should censor media to slow it down, but in terms of if you are using social media, if you are analyzing social media for a real process, you need to slow that process down. There's this desire when you see, geez, there was a coup attempt in Venezuela. Oh my gosh, this picture of this, child who was shot must have come from Venezuela. There's a need to slow down, take a moment, verify what's actually occurring. And not get caught up in the hype of, my gosh, this has 150 retweets, it must be true. Retweets do not indicate truth any more than they indicate popularity or agreement. Take a step back. Things can wait an hour, two, or three. Very rarely is something so tactically necessary that you have to be on top of it 30 seconds later. And taking the moment to verify or at least ensure that something actually did occur, can be the difference between, information being spread or misinformation being used for advantage to discredit issues. With that, I'll pause there. I'll let Carl maybe ask a question, and we'll open it up for discussion.
Great. Excellent. Thank you very much. As usual, you answer a lot of questions that people have, and you do it in a comprehensive way, and this is super, super helpful and in real time. So let me ask you a question. You've been watching what's been happening in Venezuela. Have you seen any difference or change in how the opposition has been using social media during the last, let's say, during the last month or so, you've had a lot of activity. Is there a difference in how they've been able to use social media to get people to rally or to get their message out? Is it any different than what we've seen in the past?
Yes and no. Actually, immediately before these protests, you saw the opposition start to crack. And you saw them start to crack on social media. Capriles sent, as Machado and Lopez were calling for greater national protests, Capriles actually went on Twitter and said student protesters shouldn't be used as cannon fodder. It was a brutal comment, and in many ways has become true in some ways. As student protesters have manned the streets and been shot, there's a level at which Capriles was correct that these protesters are being killed while the opposition leaders were not. That said, Lopez eventually did go to prison over it. Lopez's use of, Capriles has since backed off. He supports the protests. The opposition is doing is presenting a united front. In some ways, these protests have reunited the opposition that was probably breaking apart in late January, early February. Lopez's use of social media has been interesting as well, only in his use of YouTube. And his ability, he launched a YouTube message the night he was arrested. And social media, some of those pictures captured, most of them were captured by a Reuters photographer, but some of those pictures captured the day he was arrested were very heavily spread. And this was happening at a time when the Venezuelan government was out there saying, no, these protest pictures are all fake. They're all from Syria. They're all from Egypt. These aren't real protests that are going on in Venezuela. And those pictures of the protests where Lopez was arrested were passed around, and they were very real. And that reality of those protests, the Venezuelan government can send around 100 protest pictures saying this one's fake, this one's fake, this one's fake. There are millions of photos that are real. And that's one of the more interesting aspects of all this is there are a lot of people out there taking very real photos, and those photos from Lopez were very real. And he's still able to utilize YouTube in some ways. He's obviously pre-recorded some videos. He's understood. Other than that, no, the opposition continues to kind of plunk away at social media. They're not. Capriles has at times attempted to use it as a form of dialogue with the government, but it's not. It hasn't gone anywhere. Nor does I think he expects it to go anywhere. I think he'd like the opposition uses it to talk to each other, and that is the unfortunate truth of social media. They're using it to broadcast their message to the world, but they're also using it to talk to each other. What's not happening is they are not talking to Chavistas, and this is Capriles's big criticism of the opposition strategy. And in many ways, it's correct. The opposition isn't in the barrios talking to the poor, and on social media. And trust me, there are plenty of poor on social media who know what's going on social media. They're not using social media to talk to the poor either. They're using social media to talk to each other, and that's something that if the opposition was smart, they would probably change.
And you touched on this when you were in your presentation, the contrast between how President Chavez used social media and what we've had with Maduro. Why do you think Maduro hasn't strategized, for lack of a better word, the better use of Twitter, given that it was so effective for his predecessor?
Unpolitical answer is Maduro's not that smart at using social media, and that's the honest truth. He's a terrible, terrible politician. I don't think we've seen a politician this poor in Latin America in ages. And the thing is, prior to the election in 2013, Maduro had never held elected office. Which is, I think, a very important point. He was never elected. He had never campaigned. He was actually a halfway decent foreign minister for the Chavez government. He understands international affairs and how to manage a vote at the OAS, which is why he did so well last week. But from a voter perspective, from a public opinions perspective, that's not what he's strong at. That's not what he's good at. And he just doesn't understand how to manage public opinion politics writ large. That's not just social media. That's his use of the various cadenas on television. That's his management of how newspapers function. It's across the board in terms of media and public opinion. Maduro just isn't Chavez. Mm-hmm. And he'll be the first to admit that. I mean, Maduro has said, I don't even hold a shadow of the comandante, etc. He's absolutely correct. He's terrible. He's awful at what he does, and that's the honest truth. And so from that perspective, and he's too willing to fire away, and he has bad advisors around him. And the truth is Maduro's advisors around him do a very poor job. The people who translate his tweets into English and French and other languages do a terrible job translating them, and often try to make things culturally relevant and end up really screwing up. His advisors on media stuff are very poor as well, and it's not clear. At the same time, there are other Chavistas who may be smarter, who may be using it better, and that has to be a threat for Maduro. I've written several times how Maduro's biggest threat is not the opposition, it's not the protests, it's the Chavistas. It's when the PSUV and the party leadership decides that they no longer want Maduro in charge. That is his big threat. That is the big problem that he's going to face. And there are savvier politicians within the party. And for them, watching him be fairly incompetent, not just at managing public opinion, but managing the economy, managing the protests, at some point they're going to, at some point he becomes much more a liability. Mm-hmm. And that, that internal Chavista fight over the politics is probably worth watching. Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna open it up to you guys a little bit for some questions. Why don't we go here in the middle first? If you could just tell us who you are and ask your question.
Thanks for the great presentation. My name is Jose Pulido. I work for Mitsui & Co. You said that there were foreign actors helping Venezuela do the censorship and mentioned Cuba. Are there others? Is it China? Is it like, will the U.S. have to step in? That sort of stuff.
In terms of censorship, there are foreign actors. It's largely Cuba. There are a few others out there. There are a few private firms out there that do assist with the censorship, including at least one or two that are based out of the United States. It's largely a Cuban function in terms of the censorship. As far as I know, China has nothing to do with the censorship in Venezuela. There are some Chinese companies, including telecom companies in Latin America, but as far as I know, they have nothing to do with how the censorship is running. As far as I know, Russia has nothing to do with how the censorship is running. It seems to be Venezuela internal, Cuba and a few select private companies that are advising the government down there.
Hi, Alejandro Sanchez, I'm a senior fellow at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. When it comes to Chavez and Maduro tweeting, I guess it's a very basic question, but do they tweet themselves? Like, do we know that they're actually the ones using their smartphones or their iPads or laptops, or do they just say, I want to tweet something, and it's up to my PR team or my interns to just like put it on Twitter? Like, how, and you know, for example, in the White House, whenever President Obama tweets, it says it's tweets by President Obama are like -BO. Mm-hmm. Should we assume that everything that comes out in Spanish from President Maduro's Twitter account was actually approved by him or tweeted by him? Thank you.
The official answer from the Venezuelan government is they tweet everything. You know, there is no advisor. That wasn't true initially. When Chavez started his Twitter account, the Venezuelan government did say that there were a group of advisors who were publishing tweets for him, as well as the president himself sometimes typing it out. The official answer right now from the Venezuelan government is Maduro does all of his own tweets. Given how poorly some of them are written and or strategized, I have to assume it's him and not an advisor. That said, I would make the assumption that some are him and some come from advisors. But the official answer is he allegedly does them all himself. I don't have proof one way or another. I do assume his advisors play a very heavy role in some of them. And that he actually personally does some of them, and that's my working assumption, and I have no way to prove it or disprove it at the moment.
We have a tweeted question by @GregWeeksUNCC, and the question is: how can we measure the impactfulness of the opposition's use of social media? Can it be measured?
Hi, Greg. Greg writes a blog called 2 Weeks Notice. The answer is the eventual impact is whether they're able to change policy. You know, for me, that's that, you can show graphs, you can show charts. Here's the number of tweets. Here's the number of retweets. Here's the number of followers. And it's all cute numeric metrics and people like graphs and charts. In the end, the real question is, do they change the government policy in any specific way? Do they force the government to negotiate at a real dialogue table, not their fake dialogue table? Are they able to have economic policy changes? Or, as some opposition want, can they force Maduro to resign? Now, if they force him to resign, the best that happens is Arias, the vice president, becomes president. But they haven't thought that far through. The opposition hasn't. There needs to be a consideration in terms of the opposition wants to measure things. And there's this ongoing battle between the opposition and the the Socialist Party in Venezuela in terms of whether they can get international trending topics on Twitter. That top 10 list that sits on the left-hand side, if you watch it, oh my gosh, you know, we got this word up to the top 10 trending list, or this hashtag up to the top trending list here. The PSUV website actually keeps a track of the number of hashtags they have won over the course of a month. You know, as if it's this big battle. In the end, it doesn't really, I mean, that doesn't really matter. Whether you can get a trending topic or not doesn't matter. What matters is whether you can move public opinion, whether you move policy, and until they can move policy, it's all just talk. That's it.
Let me take a question. There was a question here, I think, at the beginning. No? You had one? If you can get that microphone there, you can just push it over there. Thank you. Great.
Hi. Rafael Alejandro Jara, Organization of American States. My question was considering... First of all, thank you very much for the presentation. It's a very insightful, very engaging. But considering how you've described how infantile the attempts at censoring the internet, at least the social media by the Venezuelan government, whom does the censorship actually affect? If it's affecting people who are less technically savvy, isn't the assumption then that is hurting Maduro's base access to information more than it is the opposition, who assumedly are coming from wealthier segments of society?
So the answer is that if you look at any society, I'm not just going to say Venezuela, you have a certain percentage of people who are very politically active, very technology savvy, and those sometimes cross. But the very politically active people who are, you know, the 10% on either side who are eager and willing to find information, spread information, whatever, they're not going to be affected very much because they're going to find a way around the censorship. The average person in most societies, believe it or not, just doesn't care about politics that much. I mean, it's hard for us to watch Venezuela and believe, geez, the average person doesn't care. But there are a good number of people who care about politics. They're actually fairly intelligent voters. You know, if you read the academic literature, the voters who aren't, you know, politically savvy per se actually make some pretty good voting decisions. But that said, they don't. They're not going to go to the effort to get around censorship. They're going to show up on Twitter. They're going to see, hey, that picture's blocked, and they're going to leave and not try to get around it. And so what it does is those sorts of low effort citizens, you know, in terms of the citizens who aren't eager and aren't going to do everything to get around it, are going to get blocked. And to be honest, in order to get a critical mass in a protest to change government policy, they need to reach voters who aren't that base 10 to 20% of the opposition who are eager and willing to change everything about Venezuela. They need to get to, you know, that next 30% to get to the 50% mark. And that next 30%, you know, they're standing in line waiting to pick up flour and oil. You know, they are going to their jobs every day. Or looking for a job. They're not active, you know, while they may be on Twitter, while they may be on social media, they're not actively trying to change public opinion. And you know, when they get censored, they're not going to take the time to go around it. They're just going to accept that it's censored and go on. The same way that they accept they have to wait in line for 2 hours to buy flour. You know, there's a certain level of acceptance that a lot of the population has, and that's who it's going to hit. That's who that censorship is going to hit in the strongest way.
If that's the case, then... what are the main sources of information for Venezuelans, and how much does social media figure into that? And does what's going on social media actually affect things in Venezuela, or is it an echo chamber? Is it mostly international publicity?
It does affect Venezuelan public opinion in the sense that, you know, so what's the main source of information? The main sources of information in a lot of societies are friends and family, mm-hmm. right? And social media enhances that in the sense that you're able to connect with friends and family you aren't seeing or talking with day to day. You know, next up comes television, radio, newspaper. And then after that comes, you know, social media people you don't know. You know, if I had to rank them, that's how I would rank them. And social media, to the extent that it helps people keep track of you know, their friends and family and talk and discuss, that's going on. That does impact public opinion. The ability for family members spread across Venezuela, or for expats in Miami and in Washington and New York to talk to their families back in Venezuela, you know, you can mock the international opinion sort of aspect of it, but there is a large Venezuelan expat community, and there is a conversation flowing, at least among families and friends. And to any extent that censorship occurs and that is blocked, it can impact public opinion. So it's not just an echo chamber, though. There is certainly a large aspect of the echo chamber, particularly at that top level where it's leadership talking. But there's also that sort of friends and family, personal network level, and it really does impact things at that level.
Okay, thank you.
There's a question here in the back. If you could come to the microphone here, if I could ask you. Sure. Thank you. Just hit the button there and perfect. Thanks.
I'm Sarah Stevens with the Center for Democracy in the Americas. And I just have a small question. I wanted to go back to the Cuba question. It makes a lot of sense to me that the Cubans are advising the Chavistas in a lot of ways, but the idea that they're advising them on how to use social media just sounds, to me, that's a little far-fetched. I mean, there's anyone on the planet who has no experience with this. It's the Cubans. So I'm just curious, like, if you could talk a little bit more about how they're helping with that, and also if you can comment on the Cuban role in general.
Sure. No, you're correct. You know, a country that has a single internet service provider has a two-tiered internet structure in which even people who have access to the internet only have access to a very limited quantity of internet, in which anybody who wants to access social media has to go to great lengths, including black market internet connections, et cetera. It does not seem to be like the proper advisor for a subtle sort of internet censorship attempt. That said, you know, the Cubans have spent the last decade at a technological level learning some of these cyber capabilities in order to manage them. The Cuban intelligence agency has played a critical role in Venezuela and elsewhere in teaching some of these governments how to hack email accounts, which is, of course, absurd because most Cubans don't have email accounts. But they have a training structure in place to learn cyber capabilities. Now, do they learn the political capabilities that go along with it and how to be a savvy, subtle censorship model? No, the Cubans definitely are not the people to provide that sort of role. But from a technological perspective, it tends to be the Cuban advisors who have actually more cyber experience than the Venezuelan intel people who are involved in the cyber side of things. As odd as that seems, that's where the Cubans have put resources at it. And when the Cuban government is determined to do something, it tends to do it fairly well. And so they've put resources at learning cyber capabilities. They've taught their advisors, their military and their intel advisors how to do that sort of thing. And those people have brought capabilities that in some ways, you know, are brute force. You know, maybe a sledgehammer when all it's needed is a little tiny rubber mallet. You know, they have sort of brute force capabilities that they've brought along to the Venezuelans just through technological aspects. But you're correct that, you know, from a political savvy point of view, they don't have that sort of subtle knowledge as to how to manipulate public opinion just right online. You can see that from Cuban media online is, you know, pretty awful. Blatant propaganda. It's not, you know, subtly intelligent. You know, that political angle versus the technological. From a technology standpoint, Cuba does a fairly good job at that. In terms of the Cuban role in general, actually, I would say that the role I just gave you was pretty much the most important role. There are military and intelligence advisors. I think that a lot of the other, there's some economic advisors as well, and there's the doctors. I would say that a lot of the other issues that you know, the idea that there are actual Cuban troops in Venezuela, I think is far-fetched. I've seen pictures. No, I don't believe the pictures are actually representative of what's going on. I think that it's the advisory role is the one that the Cubans are playing. And the Cubans are Maduro's close to the Cubans. Maduro's always been close to the Cubans. And so he trusts them. And he trusts them perhaps more than he trusts some of his military leadership, which is why the Cubans have a key military advisory role, which is why certain Venezuelan military leaders have not been allowed to communicate with each other. They've been forced to communicate through centralized channels in which the Cubans have some level of oversight. And it's that advisory role where he trusts them and believes in them almost more than he does the Venezuelan military. I don't think there's Cuban soldiers on the ground. I think it's sometimes that you can overblow what Cuba's role is there, but the military and intelligence advisory role is very real.
We have another Twitter question.
Well, good.
That's point. It's from at Jay Perez, Miami. To the extent that social media have been the voice of the protests, what happens if Maduro shuts those down?
one of the thing, you know, this is, you know, this is the ultimate sort of scenario, right? He gets so angry at Twitter, he shuts down Twitter. He shuts down Facebook. He shuts down social media. That sort of brute force mentality has gone very poorly for governments around the world. You know, and that's hopefully, you know, it went very poorly for Egypt. It's going poorly for Turkey at the moment. And hopefully Maduro sees that sort of brute force, I'm going to shut social media down, is not a good way to go. It actually sparks more people to uprise, because going back to a previous point, you know, you may not care if you can find your social media pictures of the protests online, but if all of a sudden you can't communicate with your niece or nephew in Miami, or you can't communicate with your son and daughter at university in another neighborhood that you can't travel to right that moment because you have a full-time 14-hour-a-day job, when you can't communicate over online with those people, people will get really angry. You know, blocking social media doesn't just imply blocking protest information. It implies blocking communications among family and friends. And when you get to that level, that's the sort of thing that would actually spark an uprising. And so hopefully he's smart enough not to do that, because it would really anger a lot of people in a lot of ways. So, you know, I know the other end of that question was, you know, what are the other tools? There are plenty of other social media tools out there. There are a dozen networks waiting to rise up and take over the place of Facebook and Twitter. We just happen to all be on Facebook and Twitter because those are the ones where everybody is. And that social media is kind of a herd mentality. It's how it works. That's how you've seen Zello rise in Venezuela for the first time. You've seen other smaller social media networks that can play an important role. They will find other tools. You know, short of blocking things, there are ways for protesters to communicate, you know, with each other. They may not be able to get the same sort of international media coverage that they can today, but protesters will find a way to communicate with each other because there are plenty of tools online for them to be able to do so.
Let me ask you to go a step further, because you also analyze. So under what scenario would you see Maduro shutting it down? Because the blowback is significant, as you mentioned. But do you see a scenario in which Maduro actually shuts the internet down?
Going back to a previous comment I made, Maduro's not that smart at some of these things. And so strategically, there is no scenario in which Maduro should shut down the government or shut down the internet, because it would be a very poor decision. That said, making poor decisions is something Maduro does quite well. And so the potential for Maduro to make that poor decision on a whim because he's angry about something being posted is certainly there. And I would imagine many of his advisors would advise against it. But things aren't well planned out. Saqqad 2 may be one of the few exceptions. They seem to have planned that out, and they're trying to implement that in some sort of, you know, methodical way. But a lot of things that Maduro government does, he does on a whim. They haven't been really well thought through, and there's a lot of mistakes made. It's completely possible he would make a mistake on that front.
Mm-hmm. Another question here?
Yeah. I would like to ask about the role of social media during election time. Did it play a role with the previous mayoral elections? Do you think no, not at all? Or?
So elections at the national level, it played a role in terms of, you know, being a platform for Capriles to speak in the 2013 election. And Capriles used it very successfully on that front, and Maduro did not. During the mayoral elections, it played less of a role for a variety of reasons. But you know, I would watch the role of social media in elections in other countries in Latin America. Venezuela may be a slightly different case in the sense that it's so polarized and it's a bit odd. But, you know, moving forward into, let's say, the Brazil legislative elections later this year, you know, along with the presidential elections, I think it's going to play a role in the legislative elections, you know, in Brazil in the coming year, because those sort of local issues matter. Social media is a place for people to talk to their neighbors as well as their friends and family. And so social media will play a role there. It didn't play a role in the municipal elections this time around. And there's a lot of reasons in terms of just the way the society has been polarized and how the opposition was acting right at that moment, which made it less important towards getting votes out.
Over here, if you could come up and thanks.
Keith Henderson, American University. I'm not very media savvy, so this question may, don't laugh, but is there a need or a role for organizations, for websites like WikiLeaks in this situation? Who would use it and how would they use it?
So there's at least one person online, Alec Boyd. He's considered a very evil person by the Venezuelan government, and he's kind of a jerk in general. But that said, he's an opposition activist who has played a role in terms of that sort of style of information leaking. He set up a website on the darknet on Tor, .onion sort of server, in which people can leak documents, and he's taken leaked documents and published them, and that's the reason that Infodio.com, his website, has been blocked in Venezuela. There's no love lost between Alec Boyd and the Venezuelan government. And so there are a lot of documents out there. You know, we have to assume there's been a lot of corruption that has gone on over the term of the Chavez administration, now the Maduro administration. And there are documents showing, you know, millions, if not billions of dollars in corruption, running through and for those documents to be released, can play a role in terms of harming the government. That said, the government has also played a role in trying to leak documents about the opposition. The government hacked into opposition email accounts. The government actually recorded opposition phone calls somehow and played them on the air. Magically said, oh, we have this recording of an opposition phone call, and then played it on government TV as if the fact that they tapped the phones and recorded the phone calls wasn't somehow, you know, violating their rights. There's a sense that those sorts of leaks can hurt both sides. There is a fight, you know, among the Venezuelan government. The Venezuelan government is blocking several websites that have attempted to leak documents that show various corrupt acts.
Alec ain't so bad. Come on now. Another question, a tweeted question by @Skufner. How relevant is social media in the protests? And he's asking you, I think he says after statistically speaking, I don't know if you can do that, but how relevant is it?
I started by saying about over 40% of Venezuelans are getting some form of information about the protests via social media. I have that from at least two different sources, and the polling on that looks fairly credible. There is a role in terms of social media spreading information about the protests, but protests in the end are helping coordinate protests. They're helping people decide that they're going to join, because protests need a critical mass. Nobody wants to be a one-person protest or a five-person protest. They're only going to show up if there are enough people to actually show up and make a difference. And so it does play a role in terms of showing that protests have a certain level of popular support. In terms of being able to statistically measure it, other than that one figure, I don't have a good set of measurements. But you can use social media, you know, via pictures of protests to measure general sense of how big they were. So you can't count, hey, this protest had X number of tweets, therefore it must be really this important. But if you are to collect the big data, there are ways you could. There's a great video online showing the dots of where tweets about the protest have appeared in Venezuela, and you can actually use that map to see where the major cities are and where the major neighborhoods where there are protests. I mean, but you don't get a sense for, well, are they growing or diminishing? Are these tweets pro-protest, or are they people really angry that their morning commute has been messed up? It's hard then to measure the positive, you know, whether it's pro, con, et cetera. So it's still an emerging practice. I think within, you know, 5-10 years, we're going to have a whole lot more tools to do this. Right now, the tools are a bit off, but they're getting there. And, I think that our ability to measure it today is much more difficult. It's going to get easier as big data sort analytics become easier.
Any more questions? One question here. I think this is the last one. Sure.
My name is Danielle Bolaños. I'm a research assistant at the University of Missouri. I just have a quick question. So in regards to what is happening in Latin America right now, the different strikes in the different countries, are we seeing a trend right now of these protests being started or being published by the social media? In regards to, for example, what happened in Colombia last year, we have the agricultural strike that the president didn't do anything until the pressure on social media was as high as it was, that actually made him realize that there was a problem that he needed to act. Are we seeing that anytime soon with Nicolas Maduro?
Well, so I referenced this earlier. It's a good place to end. In terms of when I was here, when I was at CSIS last year, I talked about Brazil and the Brazil protests. And one of the fascinating things about the Brazil protests is that the traditional political parties of Brazil were not involved. The unions were not involved. Those traditional social organizations weren't involved. These protests were self-organizing in terms of a few newer citizen groups, NGOs, organizing, and then people coming in. Most people, over 80% of the people who protested in Brazil learned about the protests via Facebook or other social media websites. And it was a self-organizing protest that didn't involve those political parties. The question in Venezuela is whether we're seeing the exact same thing happening, but it's such a polarized society in which everyone is so used to the narrative of Nicolas Maduro versus Capriles or the Chavistas versus the opposition. And those leaders have jumped on these protests as this is for us, this is against us, that what we're really missing here is a citizen uprising that's similar to what occurred in Colombia, what occurred in Brazil, what we see occurring in other places around the world, in which citizens are organizing separate from these traditional political organizations that have existed for so long. And it's hard to catch that in Venezuela because Leopoldo López grabbed onto them. Machado grabbed onto them. Capriles eventually joined them, and López went to prison. And López has now become a symbol, a martyr for what has occurred, in Venezuela, when in reality, this may have just been students who are protesting joined by other citizens who wanted to protest because they're tired of how conditions are going. And both the government and the leadership of the opposition benefit from that polarization that raises them both up. And in reality, I think there is a majority of Venezuelan society that is not happy with how the way things are going. That's not necessarily saying they're pro-opposition in the sense that they're pro-López or pro-Machado or pro-Capriles. But they are, and that's not to say that they're against Chavismo as an ideology. I think they're just frustrated with the fact that they have to wait in line so long to buy things and that there aren't enough jobs and that there is the inflation and that there is the level of crime that exists. And to the extent that you have what I would believe to be a clear majority of Venezuelans who aren't happy with how things are. That's not to make a political statement about who they support, just to, they aren't happy with how things are in the country. Their ability to organize via social media is somewhat hindered by that political process in which the leadership fights it out and forces people to take sides. You must take side. You must be pro-Capriles or pro-Maduro. There's probably a third of Venezuelans, if not more, who don't want to make that choice. They just want, they want an effective, pragmatic government that is working for them, and they don't have it today. And so we may be seeing those sorts of citizen things and having a hard time seeing it due to the political situation there.
All right. Well, James, thank you for your perspective. Thanks for everything. This has been very good, as usual. You always add something to the discourse on these topics. So I appreciate it. You're always welcome here. And until next time.
Right. Thank you.